충무.
I picture my life to be a lot different.
Hello, much calmer, and welcome to They Mighty Mariners Lookout Landing Prospects Focused Podcast. I am your host, John Troopin, joined today by both my co-hosts. We have Kate Prusser, managing editor of LookoutLanding.com. Kate?
Hello, John. You're coming in hot. Coming in hot. I had to mute you for a second. It's a lot of energy. I'm not at that energy level. So
it's fair. It's 3 hours later here.
I'm out here representing all the people for whom noon is the new 9 a.m. So
it is kind of the new 9
a.m. Just know I see you. I value you. I validate you.
And you're turning my audio down.
I will speak your truth. Yes, 100%.
Well, we also have sharing your noontime sort of stupor, potentially, Joe Doyle, staff writer. Joe, how's noon treating you as well?
Noon is going okay in the on the West Coast. It seems like the three of us are somewhere between a cup of coffee and a cocktail, and I think you're the latter, sir.
Potentially. It's not noon everywhere. It's sort of the opposite of Jimmy Buffett's vibe, but gets the same sort of mindset through.
Yeah, that 3 hour time. I mean, time in quarantine works really weird. I don't know if you've noticed that. I don't know how March was 700 years long and April was 1 second.
Well, because April was just one long day.
April was one long day. And now May, I'm like, oh my God, it's May 4th already. It's all the Star Wars jokes. It's Taco Tuesday and Cinco de Mayo tomorrow.
I can't believe the Star Wars jokes are still a thing right now.
They will never die.
They will never die.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I feel like we're positioned to just rip-roar right through May, too. So I guess it would make sense that Joe and I are like sleepy zombies and John has got the lampshade on his head. Figuratively, but maybe also literally. I don't know how you live your life. I'm not judging.
Time is just, it's a circle, it's a construct, but it's a much, much bigger circle.
That's a good way of putting it. Well, we're gonna take a trip back in time today.
Nice segue.
Not necessarily to
sending that one into the 2020 Segway Awards.
Thank you.
Oh, they were canceled. Sorry.
Oh no.
I don't know that it's a better time. I suppose literally than right now, it is a better time. But baseball wise, or at least Mariners wise, I'm not sure. Heading back to the early and mid to 2010s was all that cheerier of a time. We're getting further into our draft prep. Obviously, we talked to a few different sort of prospect and draft experts recently. We're going to try and do some more things like that. But we're going to really look into the history of the Mariners drafting in the previous decade and look at some of the things that have changed, why some of the things worked or didn't work more often, unfortunately, and see sort of what is trending forward and what seems to be more important, more impactful, and what we can hopefully expect from the draft this year as the Mariners, in as much as anyone can, try to plan for the future right now, attempt to build a young core of talent that can bring better days, at least on the baseball field, in the 2020s.
And this is the first, this is a series. If the idea of going back in time and looking into the past drafts is not that appealing to you, I will admit it's not that appealing to me. Just understand it as part of the larger...
You gave away too much creative control.
Understand it as part of the larger framework of just looking at what has brought the organization to where we are now and also looking towards the future. And if you haven't listened to the podcasts with Jim Callis and
Jonathan Mayo,
make sure to go back and do that as kind of a look forward into this year's draft and kind of a general sense, because those were excellent guests. We were really lucky to get them, thanks to Joe. And then maybe circle back to this and we'll be working our way forward. But I would definitely recommend that you listen to those if you have not yet.
Yeah, it's the focus is on figuring out what's going to make a difference for the future, and particularly what I'm interested in is, you know, a lot of the things that the Mariners tried to do in, you know, from 2013 and even before that, but we're not going to go that far back necessarily, didn't really work out. But
you don't say.
Well, you know, you may not have noticed, but things haven't been as peachy keen. However, at the time, many of the things may have looked like, oh, this was a great pick, or oh, this is very exciting. And it wasn't just, you know, local, sort of the local angle thinking that. It was, oh, yeah, that's probably who the Mariners should pick at that circumstance. Or, oh, they got a good, you know, find on this guy. Or, oh, you know, this guy could really be something if they can figure it out with them. And by and large, that didn't happen. But that's what it will often look like every year. So we're gonna try and look at starting in 2013. And today we're going to talk about 2013, 2014, 2015, the last of the Jack Z drafts. And then next week we're going to go on to the DePoto drafts, and as well as then have some looks at this year's upcoming draft. So some more forward looking stuff. But let's just start with 2013. I'm saying that with a sort of up, you know, you can hear my voice kind of going up as though that should be an exciting thing.
John, you're burying the lead here.
Friends, it was not so exciting. So in 2013, you guys, to refresh anyone's memory, that was the year the Mariners had the 12th overall pick. And they went with DJ Peterson, third baseman out of the University of New Mexico. And he didn't really work out. But at the time, you know, I don't know if you guys, I don't know how heavily you guys were involved in the draft or in sort of prospect stuff at the time. Do you either you have a memory of what your feelings were about DJ Peterson at the time when that pick was made?
For me, when they took Peterson, I was totally on board. I wasn't, you know, this deep into prospects and minor league ball and everything like that, but whenever, you know, draft pundits throw around the best college hitter in the draft, a hit tool that can't miss, that was something that I was really excited about, because, you know, if you can hit, they'll find a spot for you.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that just didn't really happen. And some of that isn't really DJ's fault. I remember he got hit in the face with a line drive at one point when he was starting to heat up.
I believe it was a pitch, wasn't it?
Yeah, or maybe it was a pitch. Yeah. I don't know. There's been a lot of Mariners getting hit in the face with baseballs, yeah. So yeah. It'd be nice if that slowed up, but
Need to get everyone a Giancarlo Stanton G mask kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. But really quick, just to kind of sum up my thoughts on the Peterson pick, I do remember that when the pick was coming for Seattle, Reese McGuire, the local kid, was another option, but the team had just selected Zanino the year before that, so he didn't make a lot of sense. And then I do remember J.P. Crawford being like the next best prep shortstop on the board that a lot of people were excited about. And they obviously didn't go that route at the time. So, no, looking back, I think Peterson was the right pick at the time.
I'm going to channel former LL prospect expert Ethan Novak, who was... DJ Peterson was like his guy, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that always kind of influences how you feel about something. I know at Fangraphs, they were a little doubtful that he was going to stick at third. I think that that was the big question about him, specifically looking at how advanced his bat was compared to his sort of shaky third base abilities. So there were some voices that questioned the wisdom of the pick. But generally, this was received really well. I mean, yeah. This was supposed to be, he was supposed to be the can't miss bat of the draft. So mm-hmm. I think it's important to recognize, like, DJ Peterson did not work in the Mariners system, and that's a whole other situation. But the pick was at the time, other than the question about the can he play third base for reals, but will it matter? Because like Joe was saying, like, if you can hit, they'll find a place for you. So the bat was just supposedly the surest thing. When you hear draft experts talk about this is the most advanced bat in the college draft, this is the most advanced bat in the draft, this is the best pure hitter, like, those were the things they were saying about DJ Peterson, which I wasn't around at the time. I was still living back east, but all of those things would have, that's like Kate Catnip, right? Like, pure hitter, like, those are my favorite things. So I wasn't here, but I would have been all in on the DJ Peterson train.
And one other thing that should be mentioned, there were already people resigned to the fact that DJ might have to move to first. That was already on people's radars. Mm-hmm. So the defensive inability, you know, wasn't something that was totally foreign to people. It wasn't like he was a below average defender that they were going to try to make work at third base. People had already had preconceived thoughts of him moving across the diamond. That's how good the bat was. Like, it will still translate to first base. And he just didn't develop like many anticipated.
So if we're pulling a comp from this year's draft, would you say maybe, does he have like a Spencer Torkelson kind of, like, yeah, Torkelson is pretty defensively limited. He's probably a first baseman, but the bat is going to get him selected in the top five picks anyway, right? So would you compare Peterson to Torkelson, maybe just like with slightly less power?
I think, if I'm being totally honest, and this might come as a surprise, I think Torkelson is more athletic than DJ Peterson was. I think that he moves better on the base paths than DJ Peterson did. If I were to make a comp to this year's draft class for Peterson, that is a tough one.
Yeah, there's not exactly like I don't know if I'm big hitters, right? There's sort of,
oh, you know what? I got one. Blaze Jordan.
Oh.
And yeah, I know there's a ton of holes in that, but he's 17. He's probably going to have to move off of third base, but, you know, a lot of people a year and a half ago, thought Blaze had the best high school bat in this class. So he's a decent comp, but I don't think there's any college players that just have a bat that's such a carrying tool that it totally outweighs what they can provide in the field and on the bases.
I think that's interesting because Torkelson, I do think, is somebody who's gotten a little downgraded defensively, whereas he's just been playing that, and his bat is good enough to play there in college. But I listened to Hunter Bishop talk about him, actually give a scouting report on him, and I think that you're right. Like, the industry as a whole has kind of been underselling his athleticism. I would also say, like, obviously there are some comparisons to be made just because they're both New Mexico, but Nick Gonzalez, who is much more athletic as a prospect, probably doesn't have the power. But there have been so many questions about the hitting environment that Gonzalez hits in, because he's in, you know, altitude and the ball flies and it's New Mexico. And I wonder if there was any of that talk with DJ Peterson. I don't remember. I haven't seen any of it.
There certainly was a degree of that. I think, like you said, I think that makes a significant difference for for Nick Gonzalez, just in that, like, the baseline is so much higher because he is probably going to be able to handle, you know, he's going to be able to handle a better position defensively. I think Peterson may have had even more. I don't actually recall New Mexico versus New Mexico State, which one has a higher elevation. I think they're both pretty dang
they're
high.
They're both over 5,000 square feet. But I think one thing that differentiates Gonzalez from DJ is Gonzalez has been the literal best hitter in collegiate baseball for 18 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has not slowed down. He had the highest batting average in 2019. He had the highest batting average. I think he had the highest batting average when things were called off in 2020. If not, he was like number one or number two. And he was the MVP of the Cape Cod League, which is not at altitude, which is with a wooden bat, which is against premier talent. And DJ played in the Cape Cod League, 8 games, 27 at-bats. He hit 185. So, you know, maybe that's something to take into consideration. That might have been a miss by the scouting department in Seattle, but again... there were so many people that said he was the best college bat at the time.
I will point out that the University of New Mexico is about 4,700 feet above sea level, whereas New Mexico State is 5,700 feet above sea level. So there is a difference there.
Okay. So Gonzalez is even a little bit higher up, which... Although both of those are higher than Coors, so, you know... Yeah, so that is pretty impressive.
Oh no, sorry. New Mexico State is also about 4,700 feet. That's okay. New Mexico in general. That's their average. But suffice it to say, it is an enhanced offensive environment probably across the state.
Yeah,
and just and a I don't, good. I don't, oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say I don't think altitude can totally explain hitting, you know, 470. No. For 18 months.
No, for sure.
DJ never did that either, you know?
I think it's good to... I'm excited about Nick Gonzalez. I think Nick Gonzalez is a better prospect than DJ Peterson in a lot of ways. But it is interesting to kind of look back at these things and be like, wow, this was... he was talked about kind of in the same breaths that we use with Nick Gonzalez right now. Regarded very similarly as a prospect. And it's just a reminder that, like, the raw talent can only get you so far. And this will be a recurring theme throughout this podcast, I'm pretty sure. But other huge piece of it is, of course, development.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So another guy who was taken in this draft, we had the framework on this, but Joe mentioned this while we were doing sort of prep for this. It's not exactly easy to do sort of a best worst kind of pick. Particularly beyond like the fifth round, I think was sort of the line you mentioned. Just because many picks, and a lot of it can be like, okay, you took a guy here so that you could afford, you know, to sign so and so somewhere else.
Right. I mean, and after the fifth round, there's a general, for the most part, there's a general expectation that whatever you get is going to be house money. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of, like, big league, huge ceiling aspirations after that point.
Yeah. So with that sort of in mind, Seattle really, for even with DJ Peterson, you know, making it to AAA and ultimately not making the bigs, although he did play in 2019, but, you know, just kind of flaming out more or less. You did still get a fair number of big leaguers out of this draft. And I don't know off the top of my head what sort of the average number of big leaguers is that a team might get from any given draft. I would imagine it's probably something like 4 to 7, something like that. But, I mean, Seattle got 3rd-round pick, 5th-round pick, 7th, 8th, 10th, 11th, 14th and 17th rounders all made the big leagues, and or all have made the big leagues thus far, and most of those were with the Mariners. So in a sense, this was not a complete catastrophe of a draft. But the problem was the picks that they took with those sort of most vital, the highest profile picks, they were misses. So you had DJ Peterson, and to that sort of the talent only is part of the equation. You know, you had Austin Wilson, who is this huge, very toolsy. I think he was listed at 6'5", like 240. Outfielder, great arm, tons of power. Right fielder, could play some center field. Plenty of speed.
Looked like the Greek god of baseball. Like, looked like what looked like he came out of central casting from Hollywood for a baseball player. Unfortunately, also played baseball like an actor playing a baseball player would.
And you know, it's sort of the archetype that got Jack Z sort of teased a bit, was like he would fall in love with these huge toolsy guys, but then they would always flame out. You know, Austin Wilson was picked 49th overall in the second round. And, you know, obviously it didn't work out, but Baseball America had him ranked in their top 30, right next to Aaron Judge, right next to Marco Gonzalez. So it's not like this was a reach. You know, people that talk about, you know, we'll talk about Gareth Morgan in a sec, but even that, you know, people talked about that as a reach. He's in that same, you know, he's sort of in the second round range, which is around where the Mariners took him. But
yeah, and I want to point out too that like happen. Before he got drafted, the summer before he got drafted, Wilson in the Cape Cod League hit .312 and slugged .623, six home runs, 77 at bats. So like, you know, he had a ton of buzz. He had these incredible good looks. He had this baseball pedigree. He came like from Harvard Westlake. Obviously that's a huge high school program. Went to Stanford. You know, parents both held multiple degrees, MBAs, smart kid, well-spoke. I mean, he just, again, hit on all these surface-level things, and then the numbers looked good, and he was this huge physical specimen. I mean, you're looking between him and Aaron Judge, and you're like, well, who am I going to pick here? Aaron Judge has a gap in the front of his teeth, not the face of your franchise.
He's 18.
Boom. Austin Wilson. Yeah.
I think Austin Wilson is the perfect example of when I don't mean this in a negative way per se. I think he's a perfect example of when a player development staff can just, when it doesn't work, when the player development fails. Because coming out of Stanford, everyone knew, despite the production, everyone knew that Austin Wilson was going to be a project. The swing wasn't, it was a flat swing. It wasn't going to generate any power, and everyone knew that he was going to need a lot of work to get that to the point where it could be valuable at the big league level. He could run, he could field, he could throw, which is great, but as an outfielder, especially a right fielder like I believe Austin Wilson was built into, you got to be able to hit, and they just never got him to the point where he could hit, and frankly they never really got him close. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think he ran like 30% strikeout rate basically all the time in his pro ball career.
But, you know, DJ Peterson didn't make it, but he made it to AAA and was like an average hitter in AAA. At you know, which is like, obviously that's not what you're looking for from your first round pick, but it's like, it wasn't like, oh, this guy doesn't belong, you know, in the upper echelons of baseball. It was like, well, this doesn't work for what else he can do. Nothing Austin Wilson was able to get to ultimately. And
I give Austin Wilson a little bit of credit and give the Mariners a little bit of credit here. I did find an article that Baseball America wrote here last year by J.J. Cooper. From 1981 until, let me make sure this is correct, from 1981 to 2010, only 50% of second-round picks made the big leagues. Yeah. And after the 10th round, which we've talked about a lot, after the 10th round, only 8% of draftees actually make the big leagues. So the fact that Seattle had, what was it, like 7 out of their top 14 picks? Something like that. It was like, you know, half of their top 14 picks. The fact that 50% of their top 14 picks made it and their first two picks didn't make it, which is, you know, first round pick here is 78%. 78% in the first round. 52% in the second round. Neither one of those guys made it. Everyone else after that is at least a 39% chance or worse, and they had 7 of them, which is, if you ask me, that's a good draft. Like, that's a successful draft. To get 7 big leaguers out of the top 20 rounds, 15 rounds, that's a success.
Yeah. Well, and particularly because, obviously, that none of the players in that draft are, well, one player from the 2013 draft is still in the Mariners organization. That would be 37th round pick Jordan Cowan.
J-Cow Fo Show, his Twitter handle. I can never make
just a kid from Kent.
Just a kid from Kent, local kid. Yeah, and, you know, has had a ton of injuries. You know, was going to be in Tacoma or whatever the equivalent of Tacoma is this year. You know, I mean, like, probably not going to have a lengthy big league career, but at least has made it way further than most 37th round picks. But, like, Seattle turned this draft into not necessarily a ton of big leaguers, but Tyler O'Neill, that turned into Marco Gonzalez, who is the best pitcher on the team, like, and has been for years,
a like, long time. Yeah.
Also a 2013 first rounder.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Same draft, you know, Emilio Pagan
turned into
Ryan Healy, you know, they're not all winners, but in, you know, Emilio Pagan, a 10th round pick, turned into a big leaguer who at that point had success, like a big league position player who at that point had some success and who looked like they could be, you know, a reasonable option at the big league level. You know,
that was a good trade. Yeah. I mean,
bad results, that good sense. Process.
Bad results, but that really was a well thought out trade.
Yeah. You know, Zach Littell, he turned into James Pazos, who was very
was good
for a year and then not so good.
It was good for a little while. And meanwhile, Littell is, I think, still holding down a position in the Twins, at the back end of the Twins rotation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That trade doesn't look so great.
He might have been. He might have moved to New York
last year.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. But yeah, he's been good. I mean, you shouldn't take anything away from players once they leave Seattle and they're still successful, like Pagan, for example, who's turned into one of the best firemen in San Diego.
Yeah, just three more teams later. So,
yeah,
essentially, you know,
but
think
also
who did all
that was all the DePoto era, like those players were there, but it was DePoto the DePoto regime, the people in the, you know, that current development staff who got those players to where they were, who made the trades to, you know, where they could turn into productive big league. Like, those guys didn't, and I don't know if that's just timing or what, but I think it's very significant that the sort of prizes of Jack Z's classes that should have gone up and, you know, progressed through the system didn't, whereas kind of these back-end guys were the current FO was able to maximize their what they had to offer and turn those into valuable pieces, including, I mean, obviously the biggest one is Marco Gonzalez, and, you know, who knows what kind of a big league career Tyler O'Neill is going to have. I think that was a really good trade in that it addressed needs on both sides of the organization.
That trade is still, like, probably the most just so split divisive fans in Seattle in the DePoto era. And unbelievably, it turned out so far on the positive side for Seattle.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's move to 2014, because I think there's sort of a similar, you see a similar framework here, and really I think this is probably the, it's not the defining draft of the Jack Z era, because I think 2012.
Yeah, 2012, arguably, where you have the high, and we didn't talk about that, but that's where you have Mike Zunino and
Chris Taylor, Edwin Diaz. I mean, that's like incredibly good draft. Like,
It should have been an incredibly good draft.
Yeah.
Right. That was that's a player development failure in the best way.
So for 2014, we started obviously with Alex Jackson, and I think this particular draft is especially pertinent for looking ahead, since it's the last time the Mariners picked in the top 10.
And it's the same position.
The last time exactly. Sixth overall. Seattle had opportunity to go essentially not obviously anywhere they wanted, but it was Brady Aiken first overall that year. After that it was who came right ahead of him?
It was Tyler Kolek.
Mm-hmm. And Carlos Rodon. So three very, highly regarded pitchers. And then Seattle kind of had, Jackson fall to them in a sense, because Kyle Schwarber went and then Nick Gordon. And, Rodon has made the bigs and has been okay but hurt. Schwarber's obviously been in the bigs for a while. He's not been like a star, but he's been solid. None of the rest of those people ahead of him have panned out. Jackson falling to them, fourth-rated prospect overall by Baseball America, generally regarded as the best bat in the class, certainly the best high school bat in the class. If I recall correctly, Schwarber was actually kind of a reach at the time. I have a memory of watching the draft and people being a little bit surprised that Schwarber went where he did.
Yeah, nobody thought that he could stay at catcher.
Right.
And he didn't stay at catcher.
He did not. So I think there's, again, it was another year of best hitter available in their sense. I mean, is there a reason, what do you see in the Alex Jackson pick that might have gone... either that we might be able to see looking ahead and think, to avoid something happening like what happened with Jackson, where there's a lot of talent that pretty rapidly did not show up. Because I think you don't want to be just scared of taking high school hitters necessarily. But are there risks that we can see now with hindsight that maybe were or were not available at the time?
Well, when Jackson was taken, I actually think Jackson falling to Seattle in one way or another kind of ruined their draft strategy, because 2014 is when I actually started to get more engaged in this whole deal. Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember the amount of helium surrounding Michael Conforto to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thought that Conforto, now with the Mets, from Oregon State, was going to be the pick at number six. And I think Jackson falling to them kind of, I don't know, I'm just assuming here, kind of caught them off guard a little bit.
Mm.
But on your previous question, there were some things with Alex Jackson's makeup, and I'm walking a thin line. There's some things with Alex Jackson's makeup that I think rubbed the front office and the coaching staff the wrong way a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Once he arrived, and that's why he was moved from Seattle shortly after like 1 year of being in the organization. And comparing that to this year's draft class, if you're talking high schoolers, the one that sticks out is Zach Veen. Mm-hmm. As the top prep outfield, huge bat, that Seattle might have interest in at number six. From everyone that I've talked to, Zach Veen, he like eats, sleeps, he breathes baseball. It's all he cares about, and he's got a really good head on his shoulders. So I don't think makeup is going to be an issue, and I don't think a position change is going to be an issue with Veen either, because Jackson was a catcher. They moved him to right field. There's still been some back and forth on whether or not Jackson wanted to be moved to the outfield in the first place. So
well, I don't see a similar catcher risk. Now. Like, yeah. You know, I mean, you know? It was, yeah.
But, and he's made his debut too. So like he worked his way up the ranks, and he may find himself a decent little career as a backup catcher in Atlanta. But I don't see any similarities to this year's draft. I think Veen is a little bit of a safer pick than Jackson in hindsight, but we'll see. I still don't, I know this is not the question, but I still don't think Seattle's going to go the prep route, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think, I mean, with Jackson in particular, it's not, it is very easy to point at like a variety of different, you know, hindsight things. I'm trying to be, which obviously I am not meaning that as a critique. I asked you to do so, but I, in trying to think about it in the mindset of like what made sense at the time, you know, again, I think that, you know, the Zunino thing almost might loom large again there. And it's interesting hearing you say, you know, that it kind of threw off their sort of draft plans. And the idea of essentially, you know, a guy who has a ton of potential and probably was, I mean, obviously was, you know, at the top of their board, but not, wasn't necessarily who they were, thinking was going to be there for them. Like having, I think what we've seen thus far, and that may just be the DePoto front office being much more refined in how they put out their sort of information about prospect development, and not sort of a mindset of, well, we know best, you know, trust us, which I think was often what happened in the Jack Z era. It does seem like there has been a better, like a more well curated plan for top draftees in particular, like a very sort of meticulous, like this is what we want to do, like we being sort of well set up to provide guys for success, and I don't think that was the case, unfortunately, for Jackson. You know, much like Peterson in a sense, but you know, and some of that obviously it seems like from whispers, and whether that's true or not, on Jackson's attitude, who knows?
Yeah, we have not heard great things.
Not heard great things, but also, you know, we've mostly heard that from the organization that traded him away, right? Which isn't to say it's wrong. It's just
and players he's played with, and teammates he's had in other leagues, and I mean, I think it's come from enough corners that it's been. Who knows? Maybe he's turned over a new leaf in Atlanta. I wanted to point out that. I'm sorry if I'm cutting you off, John, but like.
No. Go for it.
So. We've talked a little bit about the struggles that the Jack Z-era Mariners have had in development. So imagine someone who has like Bunny Hill skiing skills looking and being like, I'm going to go Black Diamond, because that was the Jack Z-era Mariners drafting a high school catcher, which is probably the toughest. I mean, we hear a lot about the risk of high school pitchers, but high school catchers are really, really, really risky. The highest WAR produced by a catcher drafted out of high school in the past decade is Tucker Barnhart at a career 5.7. And the next closest is Danny Jansen from the Blue Jays with 1.7. So...
Oh, goggles.
Yeah, yeah. Rec, I think a full 0.7 of that is the rec specs.
But that just shows, like, if you're drafting a high school catcher, you better plan on them being in your organization for 5 years or yes. you know, 5 years before they're
with
in the pros.
With a very specific plan about what they're going to do, how you're going to advance mm-hmm. them. Joe, you and I were just talking about Will Banfield, who was one of my favorite prospects in 2018. I love him. I love him from a makeup standpoint and defense, and then there's so much power in the bat. I mean, it's kind of a high school Zunino-ish profile.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. he has had a rough go of it so far in pro ball. He was with the former Mariners affiliate, the Clinton Lumber Kings, this past season, and things didn't go great. There was a lot of striking out, but not a lot of contact.
But you know what? I mean, you have to give Miami credit. He's still in rookie ball. You know, that he's still trying to figure it out, and they're not rushing him. And he's a 20-year-old catcher that should be trying to figure it out in rookie ball.
Well, he's an A-ball. Clinton's A-ball.
Yeah.
But
yeah, low A. Or I guess, short season. He's in low A. But, you know, they're not trying to move the power up the system because he can occasionally run into one. I mean, he's a good catch and throw. He's got a lot of power, and if it takes until 2024, it takes until 2024.
Yeah, which is...
That actually...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Kate. No, you're good.
I mean, that's looking over Alex Jackson's development. Like, that was... So, you have to take a high school catcher knowing that it is going to be a long and arduous climb. Catcher is the hardest position on the diamond. You have all of that defensive stuff that they have to work on. Plus, you're developing the bat. And then with a high school player who needs more development anyway, it's a long-term investment. And the Mariners were not super patient. Well, Alex Jackson, like, they drafted him in his first full year. They had moved him to short season. They moved him from short season or from rookie ball short season to full season ball. He repeated in 2016, and then they sent him to the Braves after that, and the Braves moved him back to catcher because the Mariners had put him in outfield and was not super happy about that. And all of a sudden, he started lighting up again and then promptly ran back into a wall. So, like, he's hitting all the developmental milestones that he probably should have in the Mariners organization with the Braves, and finally worked his way all the way up to MLB this year, got a like little brief cup of coffee, which didn't go great. They promoted him after a 109 WRC plus in AAA, which is a little questionable.
Not great.
But you know, they're giving him opportunities. They've progressed him slowly. They're letting him kind of try and fail and succeed, and the Mariners just weren't willing, the Jerry DePoto Mariners at least, weren't willing to put in that amount of development with him. And I think a lot of that was on the personal level. So it's not just that you have to spend all this time developing the player. You have to like the player that you're developing, and you have to really believe in them. So
go ahead, John.
Well, I'm curious about that particular angle of it, because I think you guys have gotten at something that is that we haven't necessarily seen yet from the DePoto front office and from this regime, which is developing high school hitters. And you know, that's not to say they can't, but it has not really been something that they've taken interest in or put high, put much sort of any high profile picks into, with the only one really being Joe Rizzo in 2016 in the second round. You know, I may have some oversight in my head, but I don't think there really have been any other
I don't think so
high schoolers in the first 10 round as position players.
The first 10 round, no, I can't think of any under DePoto. But I posted something on Twitter the other day that they've only got 5 high school picks in the first 10 rounds at all, and we can name some of, like, Sam Carlson was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Rizzo was one of them. Help me out.
I mean, Jorge Benitez.
Jorge Benitez. Kind of he's Puerto Rico, so he's like kind of almost international.
He was a high school.
I know, but I consider the kids from Puerto Rico almost an internet. And I wish they would go back to the international draft for Puerto Rico and get those kids paid, but.
Yeah. And then Michael Limoncelli, Adam Macco past year. Yeah, so no. Laws, the only high school. Was he the only high school position player.
He was outside. Holden Laws was outside. Was
Damon Cassetta.
I think some of that.
11th. He was like, but
again, talk about somebody who they believe in, who they love is in the organization, who they want to spend time developing. Limoncelli, I know they really like. Cassetta Stubbs, I know they really like. Like, these are kids that they're putting into the leadership program, too. And
yeah.
Yeah, they've definitely pushed Cassetta Stubbs, too. Yeah. I mean, they have not slowed him down.
No.
But I think, how much of that do you think has to do with the... I mean, Jerry DePoto's first 3 or 4 years here, it was get to the playoffs at all costs, you know? So maybe he was taking players that he thought are going to be here by 2019, 2020 and contribute sooner rather than later because they just, quote unquote, you know, don't have time to wait.
But I feel like we're getting robbed out of the true deep rebuild. I mean, of getting to draft those high upside players. It's disappointing to me because obviously they want to be back in contention. Longest drought, playoff, blah, 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 et cetera. Like, they want to be back in contention. They want to get guys who are going to be fast moving. They've got this core ready to rock it up from the 2018 draft and, you know, pieces from 2017, Evan White. The core is in place. So I feel like we're stuck again with a lot of the same draft strategy that we saw in previous years. Like, take guys who can move quickly. And I'm worried that this is going to be the same kinds of things where it's like, try to assemble a meaningful playoff team in the next few years. And so, you know, we're not going to take a lot of high upside long-term projects on right now, which I want a project, you know, I would love to watch a guy really, really develop his way up through the system.
I think this year is going to be different than last year. Last year they went Kirby, Williams, and Campbell, but at the same time, there just wasn't much in last year's draft
was so, you know, unexciting.
It was pretty bad.
To our picks, I think they're good and solid picks. I was thrilled about Isaiah Campbell. I am not like excited about any of them. I'm not like, I can't wait to sit down and write up, you know, 600 words on player X. I feel bad saying
that. If you go back and look at last year's draft and you just take a look at who Seattle had available to them when they took Brandon Williamson, I mean, the only player that really stands out was Matthew Lugo. And I know you were a big Matthew Lugo fan.
Matthew Lugo, fun kid.
Yeah, but beyond that, like, there wasn't really too many, I'm not seeing too many projects that we were terribly interested in.
It was just a really bad draft.
Bad draft. But this year, I'm fairly comfortable, especially if it's an abbreviated draft, in saying Seattle will go with a high upside high schooler at either 43 or 64. I just don't think they're going to do it at 6 because there's so many. It's not even that there's guys with crazy upside like Zach Veen. It's that the guys that will be available to them at 6 already have crazy high upside and good floors. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. They've got more money to work with than they usually do, and I think they're going to use it accordingly.
I just really, and Joe, you and I were talking about this a little, like, I really want to see them, I want to see them challenged. I want to see them take a high school hitter and develop that player through the system. And, you know, this is a year of draft opportunity. Like, they have great positioning. The Astros don't have any picks in the first two rounds, which could be almost half the draft if the draft is only 5 rounds. It's a good draft. It's a good draft class. It is a huge opportunity for them to be a little splashy. And while I am perfectly fine with taking someone like Garrett Mitchell at 6, I've drunk the Garrett Mitchell Kool-Aid. I am on board. Choo-choo, Garrett Mitchell Express. But at that second pick, I want someone like Jordan Walker, Ed
the
Howard.
The Garrett Mitchell Kool-Aid is sugar.
It is diabetic friendly.
Yeah.
Kate, you and I have talked.
Oh my god,
too.
I didn't even think of that. I wish you're giving me too much credit.
Oh, I thought that's where you were going
John,
with that.
How did you not know you were
John
going with that?
Nothing.
That was good.
I know that's not your name, but that's what you get called when
I'm editing.
Yes, make yourself look more brilliant. You absolutely should.
Kate, you and I have also talked briefly about how there's not really anyone at that sixth selection, with the exception of Zach Veen, that would be met with positivity by the fans, by the industry. Like, there's not too many prepsters, with maybe the exception of Mick Abel. I don't think you're going to see, if Seattle were to go like Jared Kelly or Ed Howard or...
Oh God, I love Jared Kelly.
I could see Austin it for Kelly. Yeah. I would be worried. I'd be nervous as all get out about Kelly.
I would too. Abel, if they went Kelly over Abel, I would just... I mean...
Oh, I like Kelly better.
I just don't understand. But I don't understand why you'd do it. Because you have a kid that is a Mariners fan in your backyard who's got a cleaner arm action. He's got five pitches.
Kelly is giant and durable and throws flames, but with control. Love him.
But they're always durable right now. You know what I mean?
I mean, he's just got that body.
You may be right. He might be someone that turns into, you know, the next big flamethrower in the league. But like, these kids just never have Tommy John before. It feels like they never have Tommy John until the first year in a professional organization. Well, like Sam Carlson is a perfect example. But Carlson, I mean, is built more like Mick Abel than he is Jared Kelly. So it's totally random. But anyways, yeah, there's not too many prepsters that Seattle could take at six that wouldn't be considered a reach. Like you said, that 43rd pick is going to be one to seriously watch, because either they go prep there or they go like with an underslot opportunity where they can go big prep at 64. I'm just like, that sixth pick is going to be incredibly interesting to me. I'm really excited to see who they take, but 43 is going to give you an idea of the entire rest of the
draft. I would say I'm more interested in 43 than I am six, because
definitely,
I feel like,
yeah,
again, the Garrett Mitchell just feels, but every time I felt like something was inevitable with this particular FO, like, I thought David Peterson to the Mariners was an absolute slam dunk. Was that 2017?
That would have been
when we took Evan White instead, and I was like, huh. Mm. I set my expectations low, and you somehow managed to come in under them, even in terms of excitement.
Hey, it's worked
out.
No,
I mean, I'm perfectly happy with it.
Peterson's been good, but White's
been
great.
And again, that's the access to being able to scout the person, because I think Evan White is just an incredible human. And again, someone you want in your organization, someone you want to develop, someone you want to spend time with.
And also to the developmental component that we're talking about, it's not to say like there have been just categorical success for this player dev group, but if you're looking at two guys who have reasonably similar profiles, we talked about Austin Wilson from 2013. Great, great athleticism. Obviously, he was bigger, sort of stronger arm, more, an outfielder purely, but had the power, but went to Stanford, was taught to swing down on the ball, the Stanford swing.
I don't think they're doing the Stanford swing anymore. Like, the guys who come out
anymore
of there now.
But they were still
when
he was there.
When he was there, that was very famous, the Stanford swing.
And Kentucky was and maybe still is. I think they've somewhat adjusted, but Kentucky
the
had
Kentucky
a sim-
cut.
Yeah, the Kentucky cut. A similar thing for Evan White, where it was like, okay, yeah, you're like a great defensive first baseman, but you have a flat swing, and, you've been taught for 3 years now to swing very flatly, hit line drives, hit ground balls,
make their defense
the
work.
Mariners couldn't, exactly, and the Mariners either couldn't or weren't trying to get Austin Wilson to do what the Yankees tried to get Aaron Judge to do, to you know, to make that very just side-by-side comparison there. You know, they didn't get the swing to a point where he was, you know, using his strength and his bat speed to get the ball in the air and do the most that he could. And Evan White thus far has. He's adjusted a whole bunch. It looks completely
plug
different.
Plug for John's articles about Evan White's swing changes, which I think I think are the foundational text on Evan White, because John was on that before anyone else had that, just as a process of watching him every day, and making that noticing that.
You know what else it shows, John? It shows that the industry as a whole is changing.
Mm-hmm.
Because Austin Wilson, when he was selected, like you said, was ranked in the top 30 for Baseball America.
Mm-hmm.
And that just wouldn't be the case today, because you can be a big body kid that has immense raw power, but if the swing is a nightmare, you're not going to get the helium that you might otherwise. The guy we were talking about earlier was Jordan Nwogu from Michigan this year. Mm-hmm. He is 6'4", 235 pounds, with huge power, and he doesn't hit a lot of in-game home runs. He runs really well. He's got a great arm. He's prototypical for the corner. And if you look on Baseball America or you look on MLB.com, the jury's out on if he's even a top 100 kid.
Mm-hmm.
I love
him. I know. He really is. He's an exciting prospect, but it just shows how different it's changed. And Evan White's kind of that middle ground, right? Because he was in a kind of a weaker draft, but where was he? He was in the 30s, I want
to
say.
He was like the late teens to the 20s. Because he was just, everyone saw him like, yeah, this guy will be a major league player someday. And he just, he was just such a high floor kind of.
And a lot of people didn't think he was a first baseman anyways.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk about converting him to the outfield, and where he wouldn't have had any problems probably, but also.
Right. I remember there were a lot of AJ Pollock comps thrown around Evan White,
which unfortunately, as far as the health of his lower body has been concerned, has been an unfortunate parallel.
Mm-hmm.
At least he's not snapping his elbows. That sounds horrible.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That's what's happening to AJ Pollock. Yes. That didn't come out of left field. he just keeps breaking his elbows.
So I don't want to. I don't think we need to go too deep on our last draft here.
Wait, we're skipping over 2014 and not talking about Gareth Morgan.
Well, we could talk about Gareth Morgan.
I mean, I guess it's more of just the same. But just a reminder that in 2014, the Mariners didn't have a second round pick because of Cano, and took Gareth Morgan, and was it competitive balance?
They had a competitive balance pick, and it was
75 or 74 or something like that.
I forget where they got it from, and somewhere it used to show the list on here, but whatever.
Was it Nelson Cruz?
No, because they got a pick. One of you guys.
I think it was like a free agent thing, right?
Right.
I can't remember who, but anyway, the important thing is they had another top 100 pick in this draft, or they had, even though they had lost the Cano one, they still had two picks in the top 100, and
It was just the Mariners. They just got a pure competitive balance pick because they.
Oh God! It was a pity pick.
It was a pity pick. They were in the ten lowest revenues. Smallest.
They actually had three in the top 100 because their third rounder was 80th, Austin Cusino, who did not make it very far.
You know what? The thing, Cusino, they hit it on the head, though. He was everything that they expected him to be. He was a sublime defender, fast as hell, never hit a lick. And then Ian Miller got drafted the next year and took that crown.
Yeah. Well, and Braden Bishop also did the
right, and Braden, they loved that profile for a few years.
Well, and it was, I mean, that whole sort of draft is, I will say, because I was going to skip mostly over Morgan, because I think you guys did a really good job sort of profiling the potential and the also the danger of going for that high upside high school type talent. But what happened in this draft was Seattle went so big on Jackson and Morgan to try and sign them that they had to essentially go with guys who they could sign for nothing the rest of the draft. They kind of did what the Mets did this past year in taking Matthew Allen, right-handed pitcher, and then Brett Beatty. I guess reverse the order there. But, you know, two high school guys with a lot of talent, but who took a ton of money, and they basically signed guys for them as little
so
as possible.
So many seniors.
There was nothing.
You know, and for doing that, Ryan Yarbrough has turned into a solid big leaguer, and Dan Altavilla has been a big leaguer.
Jury's still out.
He is in the big leagues.
Yeah.
And
the Rap Soto looks great.
Absolutely.
It really does, but the ERA doesn't.
Yeah. And there are no other players who have either made the big leagues or in the organization.
Chris Mariscal?
Dan Altavilla, who's
Chris
left.
Mariscal?
Oh, sorry. Chris Mariscal is still in the organization. Yeah. That's my mistake.
There's a couple guys. There's a couple guys from that draft that I thought, Trey Cochran Gill in the 17th round, I thought was going to be pretty good.
It was a good draft for names. I will say that. Houghton Buchanan and Sheehan Planus Arteaga is.
Don't forget about Vinny Natolo.
Certainly not. Nor Tyler
Vinny
Natolo.
Tyler Herb.
When the organization was horrible, the prospects were horrible. Tyler Herb was getting into the top 10 range for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then they traded him for the guy from the Giants, whose name I can't remember, who threw a no-hitter for them and definitely not for us.
What was that guy's name?
It was Chris.
It was Chris.
Shoot, I was a big W. Am I seeing a W?
He only, I think he only made one start, too. I don't think he
Chris
lasted.
Heston.
That's right.
Yeah, W is almost a name.
Tyler Herb is floating around AA and AAA right now for the Norfolk Tides and posting a 7 ERA in 76 innings.
Yeah. Obviously that is sort of part of the risk of a high school heavy draft, and with this year's draft, it's kind of hard to tell what, the financial components or what the financial preferences of, high school players will be, considering how weird everything is.
I think high school players are
going
to want a boatload of money this year to not go to college.
Right.
And the college players.
Definitely some of them do.
I think some of the college players are going to find themselves with less leverage. Something we have to look at, too, is college rosters are about to be overloaded. Like, there are going to be so many guys coming in / staying back. That playing time is going to get really, really dicey. So I wouldn't be surprised. If I was a high school guy, I would want my money for sure. Hand me that bag. Mm-hmm. But also, I don't know that college would look, if I was headed off to a program like Vanderbilt or something, and I didn't feel like there was a chance I was going to get a ton of playing time, I might really look more strongly at going pro than I might have otherwise. That's just what I would be thinking.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I even think the fringe guys, the sophomores that, like Cole Wilcox and Max Meyer, the barely 21-year-olds. Like, if I was them, I would try to get the hell out of Dodge as fast as you can, because you don't want to be a 22-year-old in a exceptionally deep draft class next year.
No, God, no.
You do not want to be hell, look at London Knack. Like Jim Callis was saying, if he was 21, he's 23 right now. He's a fifth-year senior. If he was 21, there would be talk that he would definitely be a first rounder, and because he's 23, they don't even know if he's going to get drafted. And if he does get drafted, he's going to get the Wyatt Mills treatment, where he's due for $600,000, but he has to take $100,000 because the organization says, "Hey, take it or leave it."
And then if the bonus, if he goes undrafted, he gets like what, 20 something, whatever it's capped
20
at.
$20,000. Yeah. So he kind of just has to take whatever bag is handed to him. I think teams are going to do him right, and you know, not say here's $50,000. But even if they offered him $50,000, like if you're London Mac, you have to take it. And that's going to happen. He's going to be a massive underslot option for someone in the second or third round. And guys like Cole Wilcox and Max Meyer and basically any draft-eligible college player have to take a good look in the mirror and you know, they have to take their money now.
Yep.
So Seattle's, like, 2015 draft was not not a particularly I don't think it's one that you can necessarily prognosticate that well.
That's
off
one
of
your weaker segues, John. I got to be honest. I'm not putting that one up for a seggy.
Yeah, that's fair.
John,
that's fair.
The 2015 draft was the segue to better things, and you just
that's fair. That,
this is the turning of the tides, and you were like, nah. So
I was sorry. Next? I was. I'll confess, looking up if Cody Mobley was still
Cody
in the
Mobley.
He is still in the organization.
DM'd with Cody a little bit last spring training.
Did he have Teej?
He had some Teej. He had some Teej.
Had a little bit of Teej.
Little bit of the Teej. But I believe he's still with the organization. I don't know if that's changed since last.
He's not listed. Yeah, they activated him off the injured list at the end of September, so it's not listed that he's been released.
Yeah, I think he's still. I think he's one of the complex, you know, rehab warriors
down there.
The Brian Pauls. Yeah, I think actually Brian Paul knows Cody Mobley knows. It goes Cody Mobley to Brian Paul to Sam Carlson. They've just been like passing this baton of the rehabbing player. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Is he 15 or 14?
He was 15. He was 8th round pick in 2015.
So Seattle will have to
only 23, but
they'll have to actively re-sign him. They'll have to seek a new contract rather than just...
I think he's got, because he was a high school, I think he still has another year.
Isn't it 5? I think it's only 5 years, so 15, 16, 17, 18, 19.
I believe that's for Rule 5. I think it's 7 years for free agency, right?
I don't know. I'm not sure. You might be right.
I just want to. I want to take a second and appreciate erstwhile staff writer Nicholas Stillman, who we lost because of a boo rule in California. Now Nicholas is a California-based contributor, cannot contribute to our blog anymore, which is sad because we lost sentences like this. A highly confident and unfortunately bald Jack Zarednik acquired beloved strongman Nelson Cruz and forfeited the first round pick in order to kickstart the process of squeezing the bloated corpse of the Mariners through that cracked competitive window. Nick, I miss you.
Have you ever heard a sentence that hits it on the head?
I miss reading Nicholas's sentences. But I think, just really beautifully, or horribly, really encapsulates everything about this draft.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a surprisingly, I would say, low upside sort of draft, especially given the previous year. Yeah, I mean, it was like... Nick Neidert was the top pick, and that was a high school pitcher, but like a high school pitcher who was command and control. And then Andrew Moore, Braden Bishop, Drew Jackson, you know, just like a lot of guys who were like, okay, they have the framework, but, you know, do they have the oomph? You know, do they have the sort of sparkle to make it work long term? And I mean, that's the guys who are still around are ones who have made adjustments, really. And that hopefully, you know, those are things that hopefully we can look at for the, current farm system, as well as looking forward, you know, the guys like Bishop who adjusted his swing, guys like, Art Warren, who, you know, has improved his stuff. LJ Newsome way down in the 26th round, who has completely altered sort of his profile. Even Anthony Mishevitz, who has stuck it out.
I do not miss the feeling of having to wait 60 picks to take anybody.
Yeah.
Because Nick Neidert, that's pretty good. There's nothing after him.
Yeah.
There's nothing after him. There's Jordan Hicks was taken 105. Paul DeJong was 131. But, like, those are so far off from the 60th pick. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's moot.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Considering what they had, Art Warren and LJ Newsome and Misevitz, it's not bad.
Yeah. So I guess just in reviewing these drafts here, you know, do you feel, because I think there's sort of two potential sort of schools of thought right now, that strongly established sort of schools of thought, and one being you know, DePoto's regime, whether it's, you know, how much influence DePoto directly has on the draft or not. You know, he has often sort of said, like, I let my scouting director handle the draft. I'm sure they have conversations about, like, well, what's our organizational sort of situation? But, you know, ideally that is the case. But the idea of, okay, you know, this new front office has got their, you know, got things going the right way and has the right sort of mindset, versus sort of the mindset of, well, things have not worked out in the past and it's very difficult to feel confident things are going to work out differently in the future, especially because for the positives that you might have seen in the minors from guys, you haven't really seen those minor leaguers, those draftees yet lastingly contribute at the big league level. So in looking back at this, does this, I guess, are there things that you sort of either you take away in terms of giving you more confidence, giving you more pause, either about the organization or about particular players or sort of,
I think this is going to be the most important draft that Seattle has had since, like, 2009, like 11 years. They haven't had four picks in the top 75 ever, or top 78, I think is what it is. 2009 was the closest that they came, and that was having four picks in the top 82 and three in the top 33. Now, that year, they ended up with Ackley. They ended up with, I think they ended up with Brad Miller that year. They had Kyle Seager that year, Nick Franklin. So that was a really big draft, and I think this is an equally awesome opportunity for the organization to inject real talent into the farm system. And like Kate said, it is an opportunity with the bonus pool that they have accrued to go after some high-profile talent. I hope, and I mean this in the best way, I hope they don't go safe college pitcher at 6 and another safe college pitcher at 43, because I think that would take a lot of wind out of the sails, and I think it would just point toward, you know, what can we do for 2022 rather than how do we make this a sustainable, you know, big time exciting organization well beyond that. So honestly, I don't think you can take anything out of the last couple of drafts, because for one, a lot of people need to understand that the draft and player development are totally separate. They do not work in, they don't work in cahoots. They don't work in simpatico or anything like that. The scouting department brings in the players. They bring in the scouting reports. They suggest players. And then the player development side is all on its own doing the development itself. And from everything that I've seen, the player development portion under Jerry DePoto and this staff is excellent. I mean, Logan Gilbert, exceeding. Evan White, exceeding. Kyle Lewis. They got him back on track, and he made his debut, and it was a hell of a debut. George Kirby, it's been 25 innings, but he looks great. And I think LJ Newsom with Gaskamp. I mean, he's turned over a new leaf. So I think more than anything, whoever Seattle ends up picking with their first two or three or four picks, fans should take solace in the fact that this player development staff knows what it's doing. And I just hope they take players that have the upside to really expose what they're capable of.
I think
sorry, that was kind of long.
No, I think that's a good way of putting it. I'm definitely what you said about player development and scouting / drafting being sort of totally separate entities. Obviously, there's interconnectedness, but that really stuck with me. And I wonder if in any way that is something they are trying to change, because it matters so much. And the biggest takeaway for me from looking at the past from the Jack Z era in particular was Seattle drafted players that they thought had the tools to become stars. And
100%.
That has to be more cohesive. And I think that the successes you outlined, Joe, it seems thus far that they have been a result of a much more cohesive and thought out plan of this is what we want to do with this guy. And obviously, like, once you get into the later, you know, rounds, it's not like, well, we have a, you know, here's our 10-step plan on what we're gonna do, you know, with Mike Salvatore. Like, no. But especially with those top picks, I feel like it has to be, you know, you talked about, Kate, the getting to know Evan White, getting to know Logan Gilbert. They've taken guys who they have had a sense of, this is someone who already is very good and we feel we can coach. And the challenge has been, are you cutting yourself off from those sort of star tool
right.
players? And can they translate to that next step of getting guys with immense tools and, you know, putting it all together? So that's what I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, if they got a Gareth Morgan type player, or, you know, a DJ Peterson, you know, or even Alex Jackson, could they make that work this time?
I want to see proof that they can develop a high school hitter or a less developed hitter. I want to, you know what? I would just want to see proof that they can develop a hitter, period. I do think that the changes with Evan White are encouraging. But, you know, anytime you have a college guy, it's kind of like, well, he's not exactly a finished product, but you're dealing with somebody who, right. if he wants to make a major change, is having to unlearn and relearn a lot. And they've definitely, like, picked up guys who love the craft of hitting and love thinking about and talking about hitting. Haniger, Bishop, Tom Murphy fits that, too, I think. And, you know, there is a... There are a lot of people who are in the organization who are really focused on the craft of hitting. They've made some really interesting hires. Jarrett DeHart, I think, is a underrated part of the organization. Yes. And is someone who I know players in other organizations are jealous that the Mariners have made those kinds of hires. So, I mean, I think the pieces are there. I just want to see it in action. I want to see... And, I mean, even with Jared Kelnick, like, he was kind of a finished product with his swing just because it had been rehearsed so many times. He has his swing. He knows his swing and has studied it and has perfected it and, you know, is just in the putting in hour after hour after hour. So I'd like to see someone who's a little raw and see what they can do with that.
The two guys that I think are most worth watching that kind of fit that mold are, one, I think Joe Rizzo has been a good example of what Seattle is capable of, because it has not been easy for Joe. He came up and he was supposed to be a bat first prepster that would carry his way up to the big leagues and he would get stronger. And it hasn't been that easy. You know, he's going into his fourth year in the organization, and it seems like he maybe turned a little bit of a corner last year in the power stroke department. And it'll be interesting to see if he can carry that into Arkansas, which is, as we've, you know, beaten a dead horse, is difficult. It's tough to hit in Arkansas. And traditionally, the jump from high A to double A is right. difficult in and of itself for hitters. So I'm really interested to watch how the organization treats Rizzo this year and probably in 2021 as he continues his ascent. And the other one is Cal Raleigh, because Raleigh has the prodigious power already. He's a switch hitter, which can be a detriment to some, but he seems like he can handle his own from both sides of the plate. I'll be really interested to see if they can continue working with his swing and his approach at the plate to turn him into a bat that can make it at the big league level. Because as we saw last year, he hit a wall when he mm-hmm. got to Arkansas, and it's going to take time. And thankfully, he's a catcher. It's supposed to take time. They're going to force him to take time. So I'm really interested to see how those two handle Arkansas this year or next year in 2021. Because I think, you know, those second or third round picks are the ones that are really great determinants of how successful a player development staff can be. And everything you said about, you know, all of the different coaches that have been hired into this organization. Mitch Canham was another one that players just love. And I know he's not with the organization anymore, but from everything I've heard, he paid incredible dividends to some of these prospects. So we'll see what happens. But I do hope, like you said, they grab someone that they can really sink their teeth into and make their own, if you will.
Absolutely. All right, well, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Kate and Joe, for taking some time to dig through the less fun components of the Mariners' recent draft history. We'll be back next week to go more in-depth on plenty of the things we talked about today, but looking more closely at the 2016 through 2019 drafts. Couple things we've got coming up. No promises on when, but certainly we've got more previews that we've got for the 2020 draft coming. Potentially a in pod mock draft, something like that. So we'll have that. We'll try and mix in some more interviews and whatnot. If you guys have requests or questions, always feel free to send those along, and always keep an eye on the site. We're trying to push through this just like you all are, and hopefully able to provide a little bit of normalcy and you know, an hour or so of relaxation. So thank you for spending that time with us. And until next time, go Mariners.
Bye.